Welcome to the Maternal Mental Health Series. I'm going to be presenting today on perinatal trauma and the impacts on childhood development. I'm Kelsey Kachimba. I work as integrative behavioral health within some of our local clinics. I have a master's degree in marriage and family therapy, as well as a certification in perinatal mental health, as well as a current member of the board for Postpartum Support Minnesota chapter. So today, the objectives are laid out. Some groundwork we're going to be laying out is trauma versus development of PTSD, how this is specific to the perinatal population, as well as how it can have impacts on childhood development. I'm hoping at the end of this, we'll also have some time for some trauma-informed resources and practices, both inside the CentraCare system as well as outside of the CentraCare system. So I wanted to start off a little bit with just having some common language while we go throughout this presentation of trauma or traumatic experiences. As a system, we have done a really good job of recognizing adverse childhood experiences. We have our screeners. Most of these are well known to individuals, whether it's abuse, neglect, household challenges. So I wanted to make sure to highlight, though, that one thing that is specific with trauma is it's very subjective. And so, what one person may see as a traumatic experience or a trauma, the other person may not view it that way. With that being especially true for different adversities, whether it's bullying, community violence, natural disasters, man-made disasters, substance use of a parent, or incarceration of a parent. So, again, an individual's own response is how we would view traumatic experiences. As well as not everyone who experiences a traumatic event will go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD that we'll talk about in the next slide. So there's some different markers clinically that we look for in being able to diagnose someone having post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. And so, knowing again, not everyone will meet that threshold. We look at the experience themselves. Did they directly experience the event? Was it witnessing event? Was it understanding a loved one was in like a car accident or a violent accident? Another piece of this being repeated exposure of a traumatic event. So our first responders who maybe are collecting human remains, or our law enforcement professionals who are repeatedly exposed to details of child abuse. Those would all be things that we would consider exposure to a threatened death, serious injury, violence. I think an important piece to recognize here is that exposure to social media, TV, movies, pictures, is not considered actual exposure to meet this criteria, unless, again, like I mentioned before, if it's due to someone's position. I think ER nurses would be another person, ER docs, that experience of traumatic experiences or consistent exposure to traumatic things. So another thing we're really looking for, and I highlighted in the slide, is we're looking for symptoms that occurred after the event itself. And so that's kind of a important marker that we're looking at. You know, are the symptoms recurrent? Are they involuntary? And are they intrusive and distressing? Whether it's dreams, whether it's memories, whether it's flashbacks. Another piece of that being, are they avoiding certain trauma-related things, whether it's a certain smell or a certain sound or a certain place where someone is actively avoiding that trigger because they know it will bring up those memories, whether it's memories or a physiological response like panic attacks, panic symptoms. Another piece of this being just having a negative perception, whether it's about the world or themselves. It's not uncommon to have some of those negative or exaggerated beliefs that the world is now dangerous, no one can be trusted, and just a distorted perception, maybe about them blaming themselves. So we're looking to see, is this persistent after the event has occurred? Again, we want to see that the symptoms are after the event, they're involuntary, and they're persistent. With that also being the duration of symptoms. It has to be present for at least 1 month. Often symptoms may present, but they may dissipate after a week or two. That would not meet the criteria. We are looking for that time period of at least 1 month that the symptoms are causing significant distress or concern. The other piece of that, again, making sure there's no other physiological or substance use reasons that someone may be having some of these symptoms as well. Are there any medical conditions that may have a similar overlap in what someone is experiencing? So we're assessing those to see if someone meets that clinical criteria of PTSD versus experiencing a trauma. So now within the perinatal population, it's a bit more unique. Relatively low number of women will develop PTSD. The actual meeting diagnostic criteria, about 4% will go to develop the actual diagnostic criteria. However, it's not uncommon that many of these symptoms will present themselves. They might just not be significant enough, long enough, all of those things we talked about previously and how we diagnose. So the symptoms, they might have symptoms there, but it might not be to that clinical level to meeting PTSD. What we do know is similar to any other perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, the earlier the intervention, the better the outcome. And so knowing that early intervention to help support moms, parenting people, partners, babies, that we're going to have a better likelihood of recovery. There also is some evidence to suggest that about 44% of people recover without any psychotherapeutic intervention due to just lapse of time. You think about what is all going on within this time period. There can be a lot of things going on, and sometimes after a period of time, these symptoms subside. Another specific thing with this population is just the cultural connotations that come with it. Typically, birth, newborn, babies, those are all seen as very positive things. So when we have a birthing person or a mom who's struggling, this can actually be a barrier to her reaching out to support because she might be feared of seeing herself as not loving her child, being a bad mom, maybe being selfish. And so this can actually be an added time of stressor, right? Because we expect you should be so happy, you just had this baby, and you're not feeling that happiness right away. What does that mean? And sometimes that can lead to a longer delay in someone getting treatment because they don't want to talk about it. They don't know how they will be viewed. Another piece of this just being different intersecting issues as females, whether it's previous sexual assault, childhood abuse, medical trauma, these often can exacerbate symptoms, and we don't talk about them prior to maternal care. And so being aware that sometimes that can be something. Another piece of this, again, that cultural piece of the expectations based on family or just society's view of the birth process itself, whether it was a C-section, whether medical intervention was needed, whether it was a planned pregnancy that you had a birth plan and you expected X, Y, and Z to happen, and that didn't happen. Those can all be considered traumatic experiences. Again, that subjective piece that is really important. As well as after the birth, whether it's breastfeeding or difficulty breastfeeding, working outside the home, working inside the home, all of those different caveats that females experience can be additional risk factors and intersecting complexities when we look at this population specifically. So the other piece, just as I kind of said before, multiple people can be involved in this, whether it's mom, birthing person, the child, a caregiver witnessing their partner giving birth and worrying about their safety or safety of the baby, as well as medical staff, knowing that sometimes there are some very traumatic births that medical staff are exposed to and supporting, and that can impact them as well. So I wanted to break up the different themes of some different traumas, just so we can have a better kind of understanding as we move forward. So it'll be broken up into prenatal pregnancy complications, birth trauma itself, and then pregnancy and infant loss. All three of those can be significantly impactful for birthing persons or families or others involved. So you can read the slide in front of you, but I wanted to point out that a common theme is, again, that subjectiveness. What might be considered a traumatic experience for one person might not be felt the same way. I think about, you know, some people may be on bed rest, and some people may view that very differently than others. That could be considered a traumatic experience for someone. However, for other people, that might not be something they even see. It might be a positive. So again, keeping that framework of subjectivity to the individual. So just because someone has had some of these circumstances doesn't mean, one, they consider it a trauma, or two, that they would meet criteria for developing PTSD. The other piece being that, and I'll give a few more examples as we continue with the slides, but just some of the different clinical considerations, whether it's with previous health conditions, having to discontinue medication because of potential side effects, those in recovery from eating disorders, those who don't identify as female. All of those different things can interplay as far as what could be considered a pregnancy complication. One interesting study, I think that I want to point out too, is there is a lot of evidence to suggest that perfectionism traits are, those who have that perfectionism trait are at higher risk, just due to how the body changes during pregnancy and all of those different expectations that someone might feel they don't have within their control. Relationship dynamics, whether it's the partner, whether it's perhaps they have other children involved, how are they going to continue to do these things? We do know that interpersonal violence and domestic violence is very, unfortunately, can be very lethal during this period. And the World Health Organization found that perpetrators that abused women during pregnancy were more likely to actually commit a homicide. So we know that this can be a very concerning time that we want to be mindful of. I think just circumstances around the pregnancy. Was it planned? Was it not planned? Were we preparing for this? What does this current situation look like? If there's been prior pregnancies, how those have gone. If they have been great pregnancies, there might be no reservations. However, if an individual has had a pregnancy and they had significant struggles, they might be a little cautious going into this, as well as if there's any prior history of miscarriages or stillborns, they might have some different ideas and some different hesitancies when they find out they're pregnant and throughout the pregnancy. The other piece being history of trauma. We have screeners. We have really good communication typically, but I think one of the things we don't talk about is that symptoms or medical care when we're pregnant can be very invasive. And so if an individual has had sexual abuse in the past or sexual assault, and this isn't in their medical chart, this can often be seen as a woman is now being uncompliant because all of a sudden she's having these very invasive things happen that are bringing up traumatic memories from previous encounters. And so being mindful of when you are working with an individual who maybe is seen as the hard client, or maybe is the one who don't understand why she continues to cancel appointments, knowing that sometimes this can be due to previous trauma and difficulty being able to engage with medical care because of some of those different things that she's experienced in the past. So now moving on to birth trauma. So again, this can be a very large window, but also pretty important. About 25 to 34% of women report that their birth experiences were traumatic. And again, looking to see the criteria here on, did the mother worry about her or her baby's life being in danger? One of the strongest risk factors in having a negative birth experience or a traumatic birth was having an apparative birth. So assisted vaginal or cesarean section, as well as lack of support during birth and disassociation. Lack of support being both medical team, as well as if they're there with a support person. Those can all be risk factors leading to someone to believe that they had a traumatic birth. Again, wanting to point out subjective, just as we talked about with previous factors. However, we do know that there are some risk factors, as listed above, that can show evidence to creating a higher level likelihood of someone developing traumatic symptoms. Physical complications is another, again, subjective, but can also be something that we look at when we're considering if someone has had a traumatic birth experience. Here's a couple of examples that I have listed. I think knowing that, again, they are subjective. For some people, they may not be considered a traumatic experience. For others, they might. But we can confidently say that some of these physical complications do tend to elicit a higher probability of a woman having a traumatic birth or viewing her birth experience as traumatic. Psychological complications. So again, these are not all-encompassing. I think one of the biggest examples I can think of is a change in a birth plan, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that can be something that as a system, we work to help support. And so instead of a birth plan that someone has, because they might view they want a natural birth with no pain medication, and all of a sudden it turns into, no, we need to have an emergency C-section due to the health and safety of mom or baby. Someone may consider that a psychological complication leading to traumatic birth. And so knowing some of these and just having that context of this could be a subjective birth experience, I think can be very helpful when working with those families of, is this something that may contribute to traumatic experiences down the line? So the last one being pregnancy and infant loss. And I want to speak to this being with current pregnancy as well as previous pregnancies. I have a couple statistics here as far as the prevalence of miscarriage. Again, this might actually be significantly higher because there's oftentimes women may not even know that they are pregnant before the miscarriage occurs. However, I also wanted to highlight the specific for Minnesota, and this was the most recent data I could find, but again, knowing that infant loss is something that happens currently and can be an impact. And so being mindful during a current pregnancy, or if you have a mom who comes in and if there's something noted in the chart that might impact how she views this current pregnancy, some of her hesitancies, some of her responses may be because of having a previous traumatic experience, such as a perinatal loss or an infant loss. Again, knowing, again, the subjectivity. There are oftentimes women, especially early on in pregnancy, might not view this as traumatic. And so being mindful of different people may see this differently. For some women, if they've had continuous miscarriages, there might be some struggles as far as feeling upset with their body, feeling conflicted about their identity as a woman, feeling like, why isn't their body doing what it's quote-unquote supposed to be doing. I think one thing I really want to highlight is responses. And so oftentimes it's well-meaning and someone will say, well, at least, or God has a plan, or be thankful you have other children when someone has experienced a loss. And although this is good intending, these are not helpful responses. And so being mindful of this can actually create more grief. We also know that mothers who've experienced infant loss are 7 times more likely to go on to develop PTSD, as well as their partners. And I think their partners, I'll give the example, or in this particular study looked a lot at males, but their partners are often seen as needing to be the strong ones for moms. And so sometimes they're kind of looked over. They're trying to kind of place the mom's needs or the birthing person's needs above everyone else. And so being mindful of that other caregiver as they also are experiencing the loss, but it might come, it might be a delayed onset because, again, all of that, the focus might be on mom. And so being mindful of the partner during that experience, what they're seeing, those delayed symptoms in males. Often it's more of the irritability that comes up with depression. We know that there's a high likelihood when one partner has postpartum depression. There's, I believe it's 50%, their partner is at increased risk for that as well. So just being aware of the other person in the room. Another thing I wanted to note is that women who experience loss and become pregnant again are at greater risk for developing mental health symptoms in general during the subsequent pregnancy. Kind of like we talked about, there might be this feeling of guilt, resentment, attachment difficulty to the child. And so I'll have some other resources further along in the presentation, but bringing that to the forefront as well. So we're going to move now to how this can impact childhood development. And so I wanted to do a little brain development 101. So as we know, the brain development starts in utero. Most of the brain growth that occurs is early in life. And so I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about how this is impacted in utero as well as when baby is born, but thinking more of the brain development as a bottom up or inside out. And we know that the primary job at that point is survival. So the amygdala is the emotional brain. It's the one who kind of controls the fight, flight, or freeze, or our caveman brain. It connects to all the areas involved and also is involved in releasing stress hormones. So when this is how, when we perceive a threat, we have a reaction that we're perceived danger. And so we hope to increase our survival. So we either need to fight, we need to run away, or we need to freeze. Now, if we look at this in the context of in utero, continued exposure to those stressful responses can lead to a brain being primed to essentially think the world is scary. And so it can change the neural pathways to really impact someone's life throughout their entirety. And so knowing that when we have individuals who have a history of trauma or who have had traumatic birth, traumatic experiences throughout their pregnancy, thinking about how the fetus is also being impacted by this and how this can change some of the development. So again, taking from the beginning of the presentation a little bit, so talking about PTSD. So we know that there are some different there's some continued lifelong impacts. There's clear evidence to show that PTSD can elevate risks for additional pregnancy and birth concerns. We also know that women with PTSD are at greater risk, or their children are at greater risk for preterm birth or low birth weight. Mothers themselves are at an increased risk of preeclampsia, gestational diabetes. Another piece of this also being when we look at family systems. People who are within a family system who have experienced medical trauma then will go on to essentially do the same with their children. You can't trust doctors, you can't trust the medical field. And so this continues with children and their development. And so pregnant people who have untreated PTSD, we know have a higher chance of having, again, those birth outcomes. PTSD is also very closely linked to completion of suicide and substance use, and those are the two primary causes of maternal death in the United States. So prenatal stress is a contributing factor that can increase one's risk for adverse outcomes. We know it can have lifelong impacts. So the in-uterine exposure, kind of as we talked about before, that in-uterine exposure to prenatal stress can put in motion a cascade of biological and physiological responses that can impact the fetus's brain development. Exposure in utero can impact development of specific regions of the brain, such as the amygdala, like we talked about before, can impact epigenetic modifications and alter gene expression patterns within the developing brain. These alterations can continue to shape neural circuits and impact one's emotional and behavioral regulations throughout their lifespan. So prenatal stress can lead to a variety of adverse outcomes that we see in children, whether it's neurodevelopmental disorders, emotional dysregulation, cognitive deficits, mood disorders, or other learning disorders. We know that exposure can disrupt development of emotional regulation mechanisms, neural circuitry, structural development of certain regions of the brain, such as we talked about before, and then the functioning of the neurotransmitters to work appropriately. Disruption in development of emotional regulation mechanisms can impact ability to regulate stress hormones, not only as a child, but as an adult, as well as coping. And it's closely associated with the development of mood disorders. Disruption in development of neural circuitry can increase vulnerability to neurodevelopmental disorders such as ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, as well as cognitive development, leading to an increased risk of learning disorders. Disruption of structural development in the brain and functioning of neurotransmitters can impact emotional processing, which we know, again, leads to not just during childhood, but can be lifelong. So that was a lot of information. So what do we do with all of the information? So some trauma-informed practices. I've highlighted some on the slide, and I think, again, that maintaining that awareness of that subjectivity. Trauma-informed care can actually serve as a protective factor in protecting perinatal patients from perinatal trauma. Trauma-informed care is centered around safety, transparency, trustworthiness, collaboration, and mutuality. And research has actually indicated that a staff's action or lack of action can contribute to traumatic symptoms or act as a buffer, again, to traumatic symptoms during that sensitive period. So knowing that it's subjective, do we need to necessarily ask every patient, was X, Y, and Z traumatic for you? No. But acknowledge that when working with patients, if we can promote collaboration and mutual understanding about their past experiences, validating their feelings around the current situation, we know that experiences tend to have a greater outcome. One of the biggest things I think about within my field is the talking to versus talking out. allowing room for questions, allowing room for conversations, being mindful of our own nonverbal cues is just as important as what we say. Another piece being psychoeducation. Sometimes this can be something that can significantly make someone feel they're more informed of what's going on. So as I mentioned before that I would bring this up, the birth plan, how that can be sometimes seen as a traumatic experience when it's not followed. So one suggestion in the research talks about a birth flow sheet. And so it talks about those different situations if there was an emergency or unexpected thing to occur, so the patient feels that they do still have some choice in their birth experience. So within CentraCare, we do have some resources. Again, so if there is emergent, urgent safety concerns, contacting the on-call psychiatrist, as well as empath. Another great resource we have is Integrated Behavioral Health. We have most of these in primary care clinics. And so having a patient established with their IBH provider, whether it's long-term or short-term, they can at least help support and get them connected. We have the availability to do a psychiatric e-consult for medication with Dr. Drum, who specializes in perinatal, as well as we have a few outpatient providers. And so when making that referral for outpatient therapy, making note of a maternal mental health provider or someone who specializes it. And I always reference within the community looking for that PMHC shows that someone has met the level of education, gone through a standard test to be able to say that, yes, they can work with these providers. There are plenty of other therapists out there who have taken the education who don't have these letters behind their name that are just as well qualified, but just as another point of education. So here are some different resources outside of CentraCare. The biggest one I wanted to highlight was the HRSA Maternal Mental Health Hotline. This is a crisis line. And the reason we talk about this being a great option for parents or those who've experienced birth up to that first year is because they are trained in maternal mental health, meaning if a mom calls and is saying she's having these distressful images of something happening to her baby, they know that they might need to look at, is this possibly postpartum OCD? Versus a well-intended provider, a 988 line, maybe saying, oh my gosh, this is psychosis. We don't want to escalate things to a level that we don't need to, and help support these moms as best we can, as well as their partners and family members can also call this hotline. So thank you for attending. Please feel free to reach out if you have any questions. And as you can see, why don't you scan the QR code attached? And thank you for attending.